Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for April 2018. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the man, the myth, the legend, Tim Nelson.
Hey, John, how you doing? Good
to
be here.
What's up, man? How you doing? What's happening?
I'm good. I'm just hanging out here. We always like to talk about the weather here, so you get a monthly weather update.
Yeah,
from Milwaukee, where we are recording currently.
It's so bad.
It's horrible. It's currently snowing 3 inches. I don't know. It'll say whatever the date we recorded this on when you click on the podcast.
Yeah.
But it's just like we're like knee deep in snow when we walk outside right now. It's just not right.
It's not right. It's supposed to be May in like, what, 2 weeks? I was planning on like swimming at the beach in a couple weeks, and now here we are in a snowstorm, Tim. It's not fair.
It's not fair. So that's our complaint. If you're from the Midwest, you understand, especially the upper Midwest.
Yep.
If you guys are listening somewhere else, just have mercy on us for talking about the weather all the time.
That's right. Man, it's just nice to get back on a regular schedule again, though. I feel like it was forever. We had that break, but just a few weeks ago, we were here talking about Annihilation, and now we're just keeping that ball rolling, 2018. So how do you feel about the year so far? You feeling kind of good about it?
It's packed with great films.
That's what I'm saying. I've just been seeing one after another. I love it. Yeah.
I feel like it's last year this time, yes, we were like, well, what movie can we do from 15 years ago?
Exactly.
And this year, I'm like, we can't podcast enough movies. Yep. And even on the site, like every time there's a new review that pops up on Cinema Faith, I'm like, this is a great movie. This reviewer is going to have all kinds of material here.
I know. I feel the same way. And we're just getting started. I love it. Have you seen A Quiet Place? Speaking of which.
No, and it's well reviewed.
It's so good. It really is. John Krasinski, Jim from The Office, wrote and directed this thing. And it's the way he uses sound in the movie, especially. Sound is the enemy in the film. Like that is so great, man. You got to see it. Money too. It's been over 100 mil in like 10 days. So.
Yeah, I will go see it. I know it's highly reviewed. I know so that. Good. And everybody that sees it comes, oh man, you got it. Same thing that you just said.
Yep. I'm proud of him. John Krasinski feels like I knew him back then, you know, because I knew him when he first started on The Office, when he was still a little chubby and just getting started in the whole thing. And now here he is making $100 million movies. So
he would give you those looks in The Office. Like, yeah, you guys are buddies, but you right. really weren't.
We weren't. That's right. Isn't that funny how he feels like a good friend that I had once. And he's not.
He doesn't know who you
He doesn't has no idea who I am.
I didn't want to break this to you, but he's not your friend.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, but you are.
But I'm glad that you're happy for your friend.
I am. And I just hope it doesn't go to his head. Remember your roots, John. Remember us. Yeah. All of that to say, it's been a great year so far, and we're just getting started. And today, we get to talk about another good film. At least, I thought it was good. I haven't officially heard Tim's take, so this is going to be great. He's giving me this look like maybe he didn't think it was so good.
Why do we always got to do this, man?
I know. But it is Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One. That is our subject for today. And I'm excited to hear what Tim thinks. We haven't really talked about it at all. So you guys are going to hear our first hand conflict or whatever's going to happen. So I'm pumped. This is great.
There's so much to talk about in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our listeners who are like chronological listeners who will like actually listen to it, we'll notice like what, two podcasts away from this one or one podcast away from this is another Spielberg film.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, we just did it. It feels like we were just here talking about Steven Spielberg. So I don't want to spend, for that reason, I don't want to spend a lot of time like talking about how much we love him, because I think we gushed enough in our last podcast, and anyone who didn't hear that can go back. It was The Post. It was like two podcasts ago. It was our last podcast, actually, of the 2017 season. So go back there, and you can hear all about how much we love Steven Spielberg and how he defined my childhood. And
find
blah, blah,
out
blah.
John's favorite Spielberg movie.
Yeah,
I believe I mentioned my favorite Spielberg movie.
Uh-huh.
All that.
So it's all there. But how about this? Since before we like really dive into the movie, since Ready Player One honors all things 80s, and we've already kind of dished on Spielberg before, why don't we just choose one movie from Spielberg's 80s catalog that you would take to a desert island if you can only have one? And I'm going to list them for you, okay?
Okay.
Okay, here we go. You can only get one of these. These are all of Spielberg's 80s movies: Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Color Purple, Empire of the Sun, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and Always. Those are his 80s features.
Oh, because Close Encounters is 70s, isn't it?
Yeah, it didn't. Yes, that is the 70s. So Raiders, E.T., Temple of Doom, Color Purple, Empire of the Sun, Last Crusade, Always. You only get
one. So I'm on a desert isle and yes. I need one. Okay, here's yep. why. And I'll give you a reason why.
Okay.
Empire of the Sun.
Okay. I love it.
And there's a couple reasons. One is the music is amazing.
Yes.
The second one is that the character in Empire of the Sun is trapped in an internment camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if you're on a desert isle, like, you want a character you can identify with, right?
Ooh, I like it.
And so I feel like I could identify with a young kid. And then you also want hope. So, like, that movie has hope in it, too.
Yep.
So that this could end at some point. So I would pick that.
Wonderful.
Definitely that.
And that's a young Christian Bale, by the way. Do you remember that?
Yeah, you're such a fan of Christian Bale.
I love him. So I'm going to pick Raiders of the Lost Ark. I have to. It's the best Indiana Jones movie. It's a classic through and through, and I feel like it is just endlessly rewatchable. Like, I could watch that 1,000 times in 1,000 days. It would never get old. I'm going with Raiders, but interesting enough,
that's the one I haven't seen.
Wait, what?
I'm just messing.
Oh my gosh. I've about passed out, ladies and gentlemen.
No, I'm just playing around.
That was terrible. But if so, runner up. Okay, if you had one more, mine actually would be Empire of the Sun. That's my
really?
Second. Yes.
That's
I love that movie. I love that movie, and it's because it's, even though I like Last Crusade, I've already got an Indiana Jones movie, and it does have that different tone, and I love what you said about having that you're trapped and you have that feeling of hope. That's definitely would be my number 2. So if you had to pick a number 2 on the list,
I'm probably the opposite of you, which I would say probably Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Of course. There you go.
This is a great film. Now I'm like thinking about these films. I'm like, oh, abandonment by adults is like these themes that you see in these films.
That's
I'm
just
like,
his 80s filmography. Yeah. I know. So there you go, man. Spielberg's the best. What more is there to say? Dude's a legend. So check out our post podcast for more on the man himself. But we're going to dive in now to his latest work, which is Ready Player One. So I'm the resident plot guy around here. Should I give the skinny?
For the sake of your mom and the listeners and the format that we've talked about, yes.
Yes. All right, here we go. In case you have not seen the movie or you have no idea what we're talking about, here is the plot of Ready Player One so you can be on the same page with us. Here we go. So this is a movie set in 2045. In the humble city of Columbus, Ohio. And unfortunately, in 2045, the world has basically gone off the rails. Everything is cramped and dirty. There's crime and violence. It's all gone downhill, all right? But have no fear, because everyone in 2045 has an escape to go to, and that is the wonder of virtual reality. Feels like everyone has like their own headset and gloves. They've got these like omnidirectional treadmills, which I thought was really cool, where you can feel like you're totally in this reality. And it's not just any virtual reality. It's this thing called the Oasis. It was invented by this guy named Holiday, and he basically invented this virtual world where you can do anything you want, go anywhere you want, be with anyone you want. And you can constantly like upgrade your suits, and you can upgrade your weapons and stuff. But you can also die in the Oasis, and if you die, then you get zeroed out, and you have to start from scratch. So if you've built up a fortune over like 5 years in this virtual world of the Oasis, and someone shoots you in the head, you go back to square one. So there's a little bit of consequence there. And the twist is that the creator of the Oasis, Holiday, died, and he left a little game in his virtual world, an Easter egg that you get by completing 3 secret challenges. Every player in the Oasis
wait
has
a sec,
chance.
Wait a sec.
Yep, go ahead.
I'm old. Mm-hmm. What's an Easter egg?
Ah, an Easter egg is something hidden in either a movie or a game or a piece of art
or
that
a backyard,
you kind of have to look for.
A
so
church?
Like a modern day example would be if staying after the credits for a Marvel movie.
Ah,
there
yes.
You stay after the credits. Normally people leave, but if you are like, hey, maybe there's something after that, you're rewarded with a scene. That's an Easter egg. Or in a video game, you might go down this route that no one would ever go through. There's some wall and you find this hidden trove. So this guy, Holiday, created an Easter egg, and you have to complete 3 secret challenges to do it. And if you do complete the challenges and you get the Easter egg, you get $500 billion and total control over the Oasis. Not a bad price. So needless to say, everyone wants this, and there are a ton of people trying to get it in the Oasis. And our main characters that we follow as they try to uncover this Easter egg are Wade Watts, known as Parzival, Samantha, known as Artemis in her as her avatar. These are their avatars in the Oasis. And Helen, known as Ike. And then there's also this evil corporation called IOI that is desperately hunting down this Easter egg because they are greedy and they want control over over the Oasis purely for monetary gain, and that's headed up by a bad dude named
Zuckerberg.
Too soon. So it's a battle of control, basically, for the one thing in the world that matters, and that's the Oasis. So that's it. That's the plot. There's a lot going on there. That took a long time, but you kind of, hopefully that gives you an idea of what's going down in this movie. So I want to begin by talking about the look and feel of this thing. All right. So, Tim, what were your thoughts about this sort of this world that Spielberg's created, how he created it, the sort of the style of the thing?
It's just like completely derived from everything in pop culture.
Yeah. Right. On purpose, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it is on purpose. So I don't know. It just feels like any place. I don't know how to describe that. I mean, it's like, are you talking about the real world or the Oasis itself?
Well, both. I mean, it's integral pieces of it.
So I think you talked a little bit about the real world being this like kind of a junky place to be.
Right.
Unless you're like really rich. Otherwise, everyone's kind of living in a very, they're not concerned about aesthetics because it doesn't really matter that much. So like they live in trailers. They're really focused on their avatar more than they are on their actual reality.
Right. The real world is just going down to pieces, but they have this thing they can cling to, their avatar.
It's their better self almost, yes. Right? So it's like Facebook. Like, you know, I'm not putting any, well, I'll put weird pictures on Facebook, but most people put their good picture on Facebook, right? Not their worst picture or the one where they're feeling like, well, I might look a little overweight or that's not a good angle. Uh-huh.
You do, Tim, though, to your credit. You're always putting the one where you're like just looking at the camera like, I love that.
Yeah. I like Sea Captain. Yeah, yes. Exactly. Where I don't really care. Look like seagulls are dropping on me. Uh-huh. But anyway, most people would be like, well, I want to put out my best foot forward. I want to look like I have things all together, blah, blah, blah. And so I think that is extended. So if we can imagine our social media selves, and then within this, it's like extended into a more like into the Oasis. And so that becomes actually more real, more where people want to project who they wish they were.
Mm-hmm. That's
whether
right.
That fantasy or reality.
What did you think? So they go back and forth a lot between, like you said, the real world and this virtual world. What did you think of how the virtual world of the Oasis felt? To me, I'll be honest, like at first I was a little bummed out how animated it all looked. And I guess that's probably how virtual reality is going to look when we're all immersed in it. But it just felt like if you close your eyes and blink, you're like, why did I come to this kids movie is what it kind of looks like.
I think it felt like an arcade to me.
Arcade. Yeah, that's probably a better way to put it.
I know there were like, of course, because there's video games everywhere and there's avatars everywhere. But it felt like an arcade, like everybody was gathered centrally somewhere in an arcade. And then you make your choice about what you want to do from there. Because like if you and I went into an 80s arcade, which I guess arcades are, I don't know how popular they are now, but they were big back then.
Yeah.
You would go in and everyone would pick their world. So it's like, okay, you like Donkey Kong. Great. Go play Donkey Kong. Oh, you like racing games? Go play racing games. Mm-hmm. And so everyone could pick their world and still be together. And so that's kind of part of that whole arcade thing. And so then people would group around common interests. Mm-hmm. So there's a feel of like that world that the Oasis feels a little bit like an arcade. So it's like we're all together, but we all kind of align around interest and but we have this like freedom to kind of move from one idea to the next one and change our identity almost as we go.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Yeah, I think that's true. So you weren't put off at all by how it looked, how the virtual world looked.
No, it's just what I expected. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't weird to me. It kind of felt like DDR the whole time or like Final Fantasy or something. I mean, they're evoking all that.
I have to say, Tim, and I know I think I talk about this every episode, but Spielberg and I got off to the wrong foot right away on this movie because he decided to include an element that I hate more than anything else in movies. Do you remember what that is? Starts with a V?
No.
Voiceover.
Oh, yeah. Tim, I forgot about that.
I can't do it. Why? It's so frustrating to me. So when I grade a movie, I go in, I think I got this from my fifth grade teacher, but every movie starts off as an A for me, right? And from then on, if there's anything that rubs me the wrong way or just starts grating on me, then the grade starts going down. And right from the bat, Spielberg throws this obnoxious, generic, feed the audience pipe voiceover. And I you just don't need it. I want to go to Hollywood. I want to stand on a box and I want to say, your movie doesn't need voiceover. Just show us. Everything that the main character explains at the beginning of The Oasis could have been shown in a much more convincing way. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Thank you.
But that doesn't apply to every movie.
You're right. It doesn't apply. I would say like 9 times out of 10.
So like, isn't like Apocalypse Now like all voiceover and it's like so amazing?
And it works.
Yeah.
Right. There are times where it works. You're right. But it, like, it's like we said before, you have to, it has to add something to the movie. It can't just be to explain something that we don't have time to show you.
Or it's a stylistic element. So the idea of like narrating, like, you know, if you're dead or gone, like, and you're narrating your own death, that's kind of cool.
Or like the way Charlie Kaufman uses it in like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where characters are ping-ponging off each other. That's really cool. But yeah, drove me crazy. Shame on you, Spielberg. I mean, you should know better. What, he's like 60 films in? Come on. Sorry.
We know better than you. You've only made 60 films.
Yeah. It's not all bad news, though. Here's what I loved about the look and feel of the movie. I felt like at first it was, I'll admit that it was a little hard to get into, but there was this point in Ready Player One where, I don't remember exactly where it was, where I just sort of gave in to the whole pure joy of the ride, right? Like, this movie just to me feels like this sort of effortless, just reclaiming the joy of childhood and that first time that you booted up a Nintendo Entertainment System. And there was a point where I just melted into it, and all of my feelings about the way the Oasis looked and everything just kind of went away, and I was on board. So I will say bravo to Spielberg at that point. Voiceover and all, he won me over. Did you feel that at all? Did you get carried away on that feeling?
So, but is that feeling enough to like... No.
Okay.
I didn't. And I'm like thoroughly from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the reviewers talks about the issue with what you're talking about, which is kind of like you get this sense of, it's a kind of a romantic sensibility that you have about like, oh, this is a different time. And it was a simpler time. And this is where our fandom grew. And this is where it all came from, you know, from this 80s thing.
Exactly.
One of the critics was talking about another Spielberg film that I was reading. And they said, you get more out of the scene where Elliot is showing E.T. his Star Wars figures than you get out of the whole movie as far as emotionally.
Oof.
And that's the same. It's just it's him self-referencing. You know, he's referencing Lucas.
Yeah.
But the idea being like, that's the beginning of that fandom. And that's very early. I mean, E.T., what's that, 82?
Mm-hmm,
He's using like maybe Empire or Star Wars figures. But he's deeply emotionally connecting with E.T.
Mm-hmm.
In this movie, you have this random fandom that's just like all over the place.
Yeah.
And you can go, oh, that's cool, but it doesn't have emotional, it only has emotional meaning to you. It's not driven by the story. Mm-hmm. So when I'm like, oh, cool, a dead Kennedy's pen on somebody. And then I'm like, oh, that's cool. Or, oh, look, I didn't realize that was a Thundercats belt buckle.
It felt more like a checklist, you're saying, rather than like a genuine addition to emotion and story.
Right? Yeah. So I struggle with that. I mean, sometimes it's just fun, right? So when there are characters like the Jurassic Park dinosaur, I'm not blowing the string because it's in the trailer.
Yeah.
But when you have like the Tyrannosaurus from Jurassic Park involved in a video game like race, that's fun, right?
It is fun.
That's just fun. But I think there's other times where it gets to the point where you're just like, okay, all right, I got this is fandom, the beginning of fandom and all the campiness of the 80s and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That world is in some ways is a very small world in the 80s. And one of the critiques that I saw of this film was that it's really caters to white men in their 40s who don't relate well to women.
Mm.
which is interesting because I think that's also been a critique of Spielberg lead characters, is they're white men that don't know how to relate to women and who are on a hero's quest and they don't know how to relate. Yeah, I know. And they don't know how to relate to women or people of color and they always are heroes that are fueled by other characters rather than working together, which is funny because they say they do, but I don't know if they do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we'll keep going. I'm sorry. That's a big idea.
No, it's okay. When were you born? It's okay.
78.
78.
You like do this to me every podcast, John. You're like, okay, old man. You told me I was born. You thought I was born in 71 last
night. No, I didn't say that.
I'm just messing with you.
I was born in 85. So I was basically, I missed the 80s as far as like my childhood was not.
You're not from the 80s.
Right, exactly. So I only picked up on a few of these references you're talking about. Were you like just one by one, just like seeing it all flash by and like,
yeah,
this
they're,
is it?
They're everywhere.
Yeah, right.
I mean, every little, like, you know, even the characters, like, you know, it's H or whatever. She's got buttons all over. like on, and everybody's,
I didn't even notice that. See,
yeah, so everybody's got these things, and there's like all these, like even the graffiti and stuff is referential. So there, it's everywhere, and there's, I think there's more. There's at least 100 that have been identified.
100.
Yeah.
How about that? See, I would only can name like 3 or 4 off the top of my head because it just wasn't my thing.
Yeah. So I think like that's fun at a certain point because those are Easter eggs, right? Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because they're like, oh, did you see that? Oh, you missed that. And they were talking about that. And sometimes they have like, they're clever too. So like, oh, I didn't realize how clever this was. And then even the when the lead character changes, Watts changes his avatar, he's always changing to different reference, like Buckaroo Banzai and all the different references.
I got the DeLorean.
Yeah, the DeLorean. That's good. Yeah. It could have been more. Because I know that like he only got 80% of what he was going for, like of the rights. He only got the rights to 80%.
Oh, really?
I didn't hear what he wanted. One of the ones that he didn't get, which makes sense, is Blade Runner.
Really?
Yeah. So he wanted all the novel is fueled by Blade Runner. And he couldn't get Blade Runner because they were in the production at the same time. And it was too much of a, it was too complicated.
Okay.
And, you know, you don't want to, because you'd have to parallel those universes and everything. And I don't know exactly why, but it just didn't make sense for Blade Runner.
Well, one thing, too, that I mentioned at the tail end of the last podcast, but it bears repeating, is that I know that he purposely didn't want a lot of his own movies referenced in it. But his production crew was playing a game with him where they were trying to sneak by everything they could of his movies. So there was a few that got by that he basically, it was already like edited together. And he was like, fine, I guess it'll stay in. But I thought that was funny. Is like they were all desperately trying to get Spielberg references in there.
So that sounds fun, but it also is creepy because you're like, oh, you're worshipers. You're not actually.
Right.
It's like, oh, you're worshiping yes men that are creating this film. Uh-huh. But not, I mean, I'm sure that's maybe partially the case, but also, I mean, of course, he's Spielberg. He's big.
Yeah. Define my childhood.
Yeah. So I think that's fun. There are some places where I would be like, this is sacrilegious.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a legitimate fan, that becomes like this test of whether you're worthy to be in the Oasis almost. And if you're a faker, if you're like posing as a fan, that's like considered like that's like the big sin in the Oasis.
Well, right. And there, the way that you actually solve the challenges is by like being obsessed with everything Holiday, who's the guy who created the thing, right? So they basically literally know all of his intimate conversations that he's had because he was somehow uploaded them all. And so they're like, right. It's like, and your litmus test of being a true patron of the Oasis is that you know all the pop culture references, but specifically related to the ones Holiday was interested in. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I know they talk about him, like they say, oh, he's comparing him to Jobs and all this stuff, but I sometimes feel like he's like Stan Lee a little bit.
Hmm, yeah.
It's like he's, because everyone, like, I don't know, a whole lot of people that don't like Stan Lee because he's like kind of down to earth, right? He's getting really old, but the idea is like, you know, Stan Lee intended this to be. And like you have all those conversations going on around the comic, you know, the comic universe is the Marvel universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's like there's some similarities here and people can tell if you're a faker or not. So like if I go to Comic-Con, people are going to be like, oh, yeah, you're not one of us.
Right. They would quickly like identify us.
Yeah. And I'll be like, yeah, I'm not one of you. Okay, fair enough. It's like, are you wholly committed to this or are you not committed at all?
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be all into the illusion.
Yes. So I thought the structure of the movie worked. I like that whole going in and out of reality thing. But I'll tell you, as a coincidence, I ended up watching The Neverending Story this weekend.
Like the original?
The original, yeah. Yeah, with my son. And I don't, that was a big movie for me growing up. Was that, were you into that when you were a kid? I don't know when
that came out. That was the 80s.
Yeah,
we watched that. It's like, is Fred Savage in that?
No, not Fred Savage. Who am I? No. I don't know who the kid.
No, he's
is.
The guy, the kid that's getting narrated to by the grandpa. No, that's Princess
no,
Bride.
No, Princess.
What am I thinking?
Come on.
I'm sorry. No, he's not. I totally apologize. I am becoming a grandpa myself.
It's okay. Well, you were born in the 50s.
No, so. I know. I know. 1951. We used to watch The Neverending Story. The Rock Rider, the Luck Dragon, all that junk.
Yeah, Luck Dragon, exactly. And I noticed that it had that same sort of vibe where instead of virtual reality, he keeps going back and forth between the real world and the fake world in the form of the book. He's upstairs reading
in the attic in the lightning storm. Yeah. Right. All right, so it's all coming back. I'm sorry I put Fred Savage in this movie.
That's okay. And the two worlds, just like in Ready Player One, they're kind of interconnected and there's, right? And so that reminded me a lot of the movie. I think The Neverending Story works better than the Ready Player One, specifically because I cared more about what was happening in Fantasia and the Neverending Story, their virtual world, than I did about the things happening in the Oasis.
So why?
Because I feel like I wouldn't want to blame it on just the animation, but there's something about how when someone dies in the Oasis, it's basically this hologram that just gets bluck, you know, and then they. Whereas in the Neverending Story, when Atreyu's horse sinks into the mud, you're crying.
Artex.
Right? Artex.
Artex.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Come on, boy. What's the matter? I understand. It's too difficult for me. Artax, you're sinking! Come on, turn around! You have to now! Come on! Artax! Fight against the sadness, Artax! Artax, please. You're letting the sadness of the swamps get to you. You have to try. You have to care. For me, you're my friend. I love you.
So why? Yeah, that's the question. Why is there more consequence and gravity to that virtual world than this virtual world? I don't know. Maybe could it just be because it is live action and you relate to it more than just a bunch of, like, you know, flying hologram images flashing around? I don't know.
So one critic I was reading, I can't remember who it was saying that it was interesting that they were anti-corporate, but people, when they were killed in the Oasis, became money. They got commodified immediately.
right. They just burst into coins all over the place.
Like, they became money, and that everyone was seeking to get more and more money in the Oasis, yet it was anti-corporate. And I thought it was it's such a ironic little thing to notice.
I like that. I want to get to some of the performances, because I feel like it was a little hit and miss. Like, there were some performances that stood out to me, and there were some that I was just like, eh. Totally take it or leave it, right? So the two highlights, I think, are Mark Rylance as Holiday and Ben Mendelsohn as Sorrento. So let's take Mark Rylance first. What do you know about him? Are you familiar with his work at all?
Is this the Holiday guy?
This is the Holiday guy.
Here's all I know, because I didn't even look him up.
Yeah, go.
The Big Friendly Giant guy, right?
Yeah, BFG. Right?
Yeah. Like, I don't know. I just like his voice.
Right.
That's all I got to say about it.
Well, here's the thing.
He's got this kind of like fumbly mumbly voice. It's like so fun to listen to.
Here's the thing about him. He did some movies before he hooked up with Spielberg, but his big entrance into Hollywood, or at least resurgence in Hollywood, was when he did Bridge of Spies with Spielberg, which was a movie before BFG. And since then, they've kind of formed this working relationship that's very sort of Scorsese, De Niro.
He's got a cage in his apartment where he keeps him.
Basically. Yeah, he was in Dunkirk, you know, so he just keeps popping up now in Spielberg movies. But apparently, where he's most known for is on the stage. Some people have called him the greatest living stage actor.
Really?
Yeah, that's where he came to fame, was on doing Shakespeare plays and stuff in England.
Well, so. I love his voice.
Yeah,
so totally. That would make sense.
I loved, though, in that his version of Holiday is such a different character than anything that I've seen him in, right? If you think about Dunkirk, Bridge of Spies, I didn't see the BFG. My son loves it. He's been wanting me to watch it. But this character is such a goofball compared to those other guys that are kind of super serious and, you know, proper. I loved that he was sort of a dorky Zuckerberg kind of character in this movie, like the way he talked and everything. You know, what'd you think of his character?
So he's like a Silicon Valley
yeah.
Eccentric. He's like entrepreneurial, but he also like lives in a childhood fantasy.
Yes, right. He's still like 13.
Yeah, and he's like a delayed adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
He can't kiss a girl even though he's a grown man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's like, there's something there. It's like he's capable. He's lopsided, which I think is attractive in a character.
Yep.
So it's like, they can't do, like, he can't have a dating relationship with a woman, but he can create these amazing computer programs.
Exactly.
So you so once again, he's connected to the 40-year-old white guy that can't relate to women. So right?
Right.
Who's like the hero. That puts him in a category of a lot of software developers. No offense to any of our software developing friends, because we have a lot of them. But there is some level of like where they're really capable in this language, but maybe in this other language, maybe not so much.
What makes me think of Zuckerberg is kind of, you know, it's the kid in math class that's just kind of sitting in the corner, and then he ends up changing the whole world, right? And
yeah.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, you have Ben Mendelsohn, who plays Sorrento, who's like this really greedy, powerful, you know, character, but he actually has a little bit of adolescence that he's sort of hiding, right? Because that's how I picture his character. He's got his password written on his chair, you know, and...
Well, he's like your typical, like, guy that really... He's a fake fan.
Yeah, like that's right.
Like, who writes their password on their chair? Like, a fake fan would do that. Like, oh, I got to get in the Oasis again. Right. I better write it on a Post-it note. Like, that's so... And it's also dated. So that's like, oh, that's what my dad would do. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
no offense,
yeah,
Dad,
yeah.
Of course. I don't think Dad listens to this, but the idea is like he's not really one of us. Like to have a password outbreak right there in a high security facility, it's dude, you totally missed the point of this whole thing.
And I love that scene where they bring that together, where he's trying to be super cool to Parsifal, and they're literally feeding him lines of what to say to sound cool, like talking about how he watches John Hughes movies and gets down to Duran Duran.
So you know? There was a moment we had podcasting one time.
Uh-huh.
When we were talking about Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
That's right, yeah.
And I think it's when we were podcasting a Cameron Crowe film, but I don't remember which one. And I found out that you were the ultimate fandom guy, and I
wasn't. Almost famous. Almost
famous. Famous.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, yeah, but remember Cameron Crowe? He did Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and you're like, no, he didn't. And I'm like, yes, he did. And then you went back, and no, he wrote it, but he did not direct it.
That's right.
And I was like, John would appreciate this scene and probably remembered how right he was when we talked about this.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so it's like... There might be people that would group every high school movie together, but anybody that's like a real John Hughes fan is going to know. They're like, no.
Yep.
That's not even, like, they're not even similar.
And Percival sees through him right away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting, too, about Ben Mendelsohn, I don't know how you familiar are with him. Where I know him most from is the Netflix original Bloodline. He plays this sort of the alcoholic runt of the family that kind of screws up everybody. He's always like the mess up of this big family. And there's like three seasons for a soap opera type thing. But he is, he's really good in that. He's also in Mississippi Grind, where he plays this gambling addict. So he's always playing these really sad sack characters. And this is the first time I've seen him where he's very, I don't know, kind of coming across as powerful and trying to destroy people. And so that was interesting. But he still had that shred of sad sackness still in him from his other characters. So I thought that was great. Yeah.
So he's positive for you. Okay, cool. Yeah.
I thought I like him a lot.
He's okay. He's kind of just like, if you ever watch old Rodney Dangerfield movies, he's the dean. Ah. You know? It's like, all right, Dean, you know, and then he'll make some dumb pun or like whatever. It's like, he's like the guy that you use your stand up against. I look at him as just being kind of like this foil character that he's just like, he does everything wrong. Like even if his avatar is ultra boring, he's just buffer.
That's right. You know? That's right. He's just a big muscular meathead.
He's muscular dude. He looks like a CIA, it's just boring avatar. There's like no creativity to it. Uh-huh. And I think that like he's meant to be the stick in the mud. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that he would be the enemy, because it sounds like he kind of like has this in real life. He has it together, and he's capable of like relationships.
He's got money. He's the head of the corporation.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
But people like don't like him because he's not deeply immersed in the fantasy that they want to share with everyone in the Oasis.
He just wants to exploit it. Were there any other performances that really stood out to you? Because that's it. When I think about what are the standouts, because you have these main characters that just sort of like...
Don't be non-white in this film or a woman, because you're not going to get a whole lot of character development or airtime. You're going to be like an accessory. You're like earrings
kidding.
Or like boots. Yeah.
So you've got our main character, who is Ty Sheridan. He plays Wade Watts. So he was one of the boys in Tree of Life back in 2011. He was in Mud with Matthew McConaughey. So, I mean, he's a good actor. I've seen him do good things in other movies, but he was like the most generic main character I've seen in a long time. You could insert probably 100 kids his age, and they would do just
as well. It really doesn't matter who he was.
Right, you know? At all, yeah. So there was that, and then there was his love interest, and then there was Lena Waithe from the Netflix original Masters of None with Aziz Ansari. She's mostly a writer nowadays. She writes a lot of those episodes, and she's fantastic in that show, but she's totally just a bit part. Just, oh, I don't get it. And we always argue about this, whether it's the writing.
Oh, that's where I knew her from. Yes. Okay, that's like, you told me you just said that, and I went, ding, ding, ding. Okay, totally. And she's great. Yep.
She's fantastic. She wrote, have you seen
some
both
of them.
Seasons? Yeah. She wrote this amazing Thanksgiving episode in the second season of Masters of None, and she won a Golden Globe for that, I believe, or an Emmy, maybe both. She acted in that too. But yeah, in this part, she's just, it's, and like we say, is it the writing or is it the acting? I blame the writing on this.
Well, she has a lot of presence. She's like empathetic. She has presence. Mm-hmm. She's supposed to be his best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, what's going on? He kind of ditches his best friend to go after some girl he doesn't know.
Yes.
And I'm like, what is going on?
And they don't have very much chemistry, right?
And no.
Yeah. The whole trio that leads the movie, basically, it feels like generic screenwriting 101. The two writers were the guy who actually wrote the novel, and then there's this other guy who wrote a lot of movies, X-Men, Hulk, Elektra. His name is Zach Penn.
And is he the guy that wrote the Atari movie?
Maybe. I don't know.
You need to watch that movie. I mentioned it in a podcast earlier.
Okay.
So it was on Netflix. It may still be. It's like the death of Atari, which is really cool because this movie, you need Atari for this movie.
Mm-hmm. Is it a documentary?
It's a documentary, and they go and basically, okay, so here's what happens, okay? So the E.T. movie comes out, but they don't have enough time, and they need to make, like, market an E.T. game because they didn't know the movie was going to be as big as the movie was. So, like, well, okay, we need to make an E.T. video game. We've got to program it in, like, 6 weeks. So they put out this horrible E.T. video game. They don't know because they don't want anybody to know what E.T. is about before it comes out.
Yeah.
They don't know exactly what even happens. So they make this game that doesn't even match the plot of E.T. It just has E.T. in it. And it's, like, the worst gameplay. It's, like, everything about it is bad.
Jeez.
And so everyone starts buying it, and they invest all this money in this E.T. game. A Spielberg film, right?
Uh-huh.
And Atari is, like, so heavily invested in this. But anyway, it turns out that this game's terrible. People start hating, like, they just really hate it. They hate the Atari games. And they ended up taking all these overproduced E.T. games. They had, like, I think it was, like, 500,000 of these games.
Hmm.
And they bury them in the desert.
Literally?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they bury him in the desert. And then this guy goes, and it was a myth, right? Because, like, this didn't really happen. How could this have happened? So it turns out that they find some map of a landfill. And this is in the 80s.
Yeah.
And they go and excavate. They get permission at some place in Arizona. And they found, like, 1,300 of, like, the old, like, the cassettes or whatever you call them, the cartridges.
Yeah.
And so it's real. Like, this really happened.
It's like Indiana Jones, X marks the spot. Here's all their crap.
So they buried all these E.T. video games. So it turns out the E.T. video game was, like, so horrible that it was the beginning of the end for Atari.
Buried him in the desert.
And now, but what's so funny is now Spielberg film is resurrecting the Atari 2600.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
Wow. So Zach Penn, I don't know if he did that movie, but he's kind of like, when I looked at his filmography, it's all the really subpar, generic sort of Marvel movies that you're not talking about.
They're and older,
that,
like
that really
the 2000s ones.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it really kind of shines through in this movie. But I mean, you have the guy who wrote the novel, Ernest Cline. I don't know why he didn't bring a little bit more depth to the characters. Maybe, I mean, you have a lot of characters in the movie, to be fair. There's a lot going on, a lot to get to. But yeah, the characters we spend most of our time with are really one-dimensional characters.
They're avatars.
They're avatars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well done.
So everybody's like, that's across the board. Everyone thinks that, but they're like, well, you know, maybe Indiana Jones is too.
Mm.
Whoa.
Careful
right?
Now.
I know. Like, where's the emotional depth in Indiana Jones?
Well, The Last Crusade.
What does he like to do? Like, pick up on women? And like, I mean, he's like,
yeah.
In some ways he's the same. He's a similar character. He's a Spielberg character who's like misogynistic,
yeah,
self-interested on totally. A quest, right?
Yeah.
And like you see, there are elements of like, well, we, you know, we need to let these this mind full of kids get out of the Temple of Doom. But like, you know, but it's not like he's no one's equal. And you see that like really clearly. It's like the white male protagonists that are trying to become to best everyone around them. I mean, mm-hmm. that's like, that actually is happening here, mm-hmm. right? And then everyone else is just like they just kind of fit into that story.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Indiana Jones is not a hero, Tim.
I know you don't like Indy, but you love
his Raider. I love Indiana Jones. I love him. But he's not a hero. No. I wrote an article about it because it really hit me as I kind of dove into, you know, my theological quest in the last 10 years, like from a Christian perspective of what we're supposed to value. It's not Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
He's killing his enemies, misogynistic, just taking them all. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was interesting. And then, I thought, like, particularly I was kind of bummed out by the treatment of two other characters that are on the team. There's an 11-year-old kid.
And then the
Japanese guy, I can't remember his name. But anyway, like, they just kind of, like, they don't get treated like characters. They're not, it's like you just get introduced to them and then that's it.
They feel tossed in and then they're gone and, right, totally.
Yeah, so I was like, really, you're going to put another... you know, short round in this movie when you get like the 11-year-old Chinese kid. And
I thought it was short round. Like,
I was just like, are you really going to do this? This is like, we're in like, cause we've talked about short round, how I don't like that character and it makes me kind of grossed out.
Yeah.
But I felt like it was like, you really did this again, dude. Mm-hmm. Like that was kind of my
making the same mistake. Right.
Yeah. Like this is not cool.
Yeah.
It's like get a laugh here and there. And then,
yeah.
So I felt like
it was all for,
so I'm getting very like much into my own beliefs here, but I think they're right. Of course.
Mm-hmm. Of course. That's why you believe.
So anyway, we could get into some other things in this movie.
Well, was there a standout scene that you had before we give into the themes and kind of go deep? Was there anything that really stood out as like, that was awesome?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Were kind of nonplussed about the whole thing.
I think the thing, if you want to say what stood out, like positive or negative, I think the Kubrick stuff was like really drove me crazy. That they would, I don't know if you're a fan of The Shining.
I am a fan of The Shining. It's probably my favorite horror movie.
Okay. Yeah. So I love The Shining. I think it's a great movie. And they use it in a clever way in the film.
Yes.
But they are still using it in the film. And I can't imagine Kubrick being alive and allowing this to happen. Like, how did the estate of Kubrick allow this to happen?
Yeah.
It became this backdrop for kind of something that was kind of nonsensical.
Huh.
So what did you think about that scene?
Well, I wonder how Stephen King felt about it, right? Because Stephen King famously hates The Shining. I wonder how he felt. It's probably like the worst. It's probably even worse than when he actually saw the movie, is seeing it even more bastardized in this. Like,
well, at least Kubrick got to be dead.
Yeah, right.
King had to watch this happen, right?
Exactly.
So maybe it's revenge on Kubrick from Spielberg for King. Who knows?
Who knows? They're our friends. They've been trying to work together, the two Stevens. I read an article in
Entertainment Weekly
about it. Yeah, they've almost worked together a couple times. They were gonna, like Poltergeist, they were gonna collaborate, but it didn't work out. But the stars are gonna align eventually. So
they are
friends.
Surprising, because mm-hmm. I always think about who did Green Mile. I always think of Tom Hanks.
That's Frank Darabont.
Okay, but yeah, Tom Hanks, right?
Well, let's go deep, man. Let's just do it. Were there any themes that you picked up, that little theological nuggets anywhere in Ready Player One?
So one of the things that stuck out to me was, this is a weird theme. It's like theological political idea.
Yeah.
So anyway, like a million years ago, I read this book called Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville. It's like written in the 1820s, blah, blah, blah. This is kind of heavy stuff. But it talks about, one of the things that his themes is talking about individualism, that we would begin to think the world was like a small grouping of our friends who all have mutual interest. And then we begin to look at the world as, well, that's the world. It's my group of friends. And so what I thought was interesting is, even within this made up world, this oasis, it became like the most important thing to the characters were their small group of little friends.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of like supplanting this order that was like this evil order, they just become the evil order. So it's like, now this evil company won't get the oasis, and now we do, and we're going to run it and make a lot of money. I'm just like, what the crap? Like, what's that about? It's like, but we're good. We're good people, because we're this small, we're this little enclave of buddies.
Uh-huh.
So I was just thinking about that book recently in relation to this film, and I was like, man, what a small world. And then the idea of fandom also is, and I know fandom extends internationally and all that, but it is like this really small fundamentalist group of people who see the world in a certain way, and if you don't say things the right way, then you're out. And if you don't see those in the way that people see, and then you're out. So anyway, that said, one of the things that struck me was that people would be so the entertainment would be so, or like this escapism is so powerful that you would ignore all this, everything around you, and you would try to escape. So like the jail cells in the Ready Player One, like that they have, like the corporation has these jail cells where you have to work.
Yeah, it's like almost, doors locked.
Look almost exactly the same as the apartments or even the van where the dude lives. Like they're both, they're basically the same thing. So your jail cell is almost exactly the same thing as your escape, like the place where you escape.
It's just the doors locked on the inside.
Right? Yeah, so it's like very much like, is this a prison that you're escaping to? Mm-hmm. And it seems like that's a theme that you see. I don't, you know, I'm sure they're meaning to evoke that to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. The theme of the corporation that's trying to take away the true kind of true religion, right? So
that's
like,
right.
So that like some corporate interests would hijack the purity of the fandom, or even like religious, right? It's like some or political. So I see that in there, and then yeah, I think it's interesting this like this purity fundamentalism thing that you have going on with the fans.
That's interesting, which we kind of deal with in the real world on both sides. There's fundamentalism that shows up on the left and the right, and you kind of see it there too in the supposedly pure group of people, right? That's the same sort of litmus test, and you're in, you're out, and yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, so I saw some of that. What about you before I keep going? Go ahead.
Oh, it's okay. Well, mine's a little more positive. So
okay,
I'm
like Mr. Negative. Sorry.
That's okay. No, it's all right. I like the movie a little more than you. So, well, here's the thing. I went into it thinking that the movie was going to be more about what, like, kind of this dystopian future and the dangers of technology and beware, it's coming and this is going to be us someday, and there's a little bit of that, right? I think, like, it is very possible that something very similar to the movie is going to happen to us. Mark Zuckerberg has created a $200 VR standalone headset, and it's coming out this year. It's called Oculus Go. You don't need a powerful computer. It's basically just $200. You've got virtual reality, and of course he wants us all on Facebook in his virtual, you know, clubs, basically, right? And you know how this is going to catch on. I mean, it's instantly enticing. It's like, hey, why would I talk to my friend from college on Facebook when I could just literally see him face to face in a virtual Facebook nightclub?
Well, then why does anyone,
you know,
text though at that point? Because I think there's something to anonymity that's still, I guess, but if you have an avatar, it's different.
That's what I'm saying, So you create an avatar and then you meet up, right? Mm-hmm. We could have these film conversations in Zuckerberg's virtual movie theater and queue up clips.
And see the audience, right? So like, hey, everybody.
Exactly. Yeah. You have people, our friends could actually see us, and you see how this would instantly be appealing. And so I feel like this is the future, and Hollywood too is going in this direction. There is a Star Wars virtual reality movie that's coming, I believe, at the end of this year or the end of next year. They're transferring all the big movie theaters to virtual reality. So you get this idea where this is going to be our lives. But that being said, I thought that's what would be my big takeaway from Ready Player One. But what I walked away instead of dreading technology, was actually remembering what technology was supposed to be about, right? Like, I have a huge aversion to the sort of Gnosticism that's invaded popular evangelicalism, you know, where you have the only thing that matters is the spiritual and everything physical you can do if you want, but it's basically a waste of time as compared to telling people about Jesus, you know?
Yep.
I just heard this conservative pastor that was going on this rant. I won't say his name, but his big money quote was, "I have yet to hear the story of anyone coming to Jesus Christ because the pastor knew a little bit about Game of Thrones." You know, it's just setting up us versus the world and blah, blah, blah. And so that modern Gnosticism really gets to me. And what I'm basically saying is that this technology is coming and it's going to bring consequences. But what I think Ready Player One is actually saying is, let's remember what actually got us excited about all this in the first place. I still remember that present under the tree and opening it with my brother. I've got pictures of this, and it was the original Nintendo Entertainment System. I remember searching for the A button and playing Mario for the first time. I mean, this is what we fell in love with. This is what Holiday in the movie, why he created the Oasis, is because he fell in love with this art form. And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with that feeling. I was mentioning the Gnosticism to say that we were created. We have bodies. We enjoy visual stimuli, and it's a good thing. And yes, we can take it to obsession, and we can exploit it like IOI in the movie, and we can turn it into having it all be about money. But let's remember what it is that first got us excited about seeing the dinosaur bust out of its cage in Jurassic Park, you know, in regards to movies or video games. So I think that it's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
So I read this book a couple years ago, went to a conference, heard a speaker. I cannot remember his name, but this came to mind. He's a theologian. I can't remember his name. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
But he was talking about different ways that we engage the world. And he basically gave this these quadrant. And on one of the quadrants, it's a low sense of care for myself and a low sense of care for others at one end of the quadrant. And he compared that to playing video games in the basement. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that as, is this, it could be, because I, you know, that was his, in his talk, that was his dominant metaphor for that. It's like, okay, so here's high care for others, high care for self. And he's talking about like, that's the gospel.
Sure. Yeah.
Love God. Love your neighbor as yourself.
Right, right.
That's what we're going for. And he said, like, this playing video games in your basement, isolated like that, is not caring for, not loving yourself and not loving others. And he was just using it as a metaphor, but I was like, well, that's what everyone is doing in this, is they're playing video games like in a cell.
Right.
And so I began to wonder, like, is there, it could, because it isolates you from the world because you have the, especially for white men, we have the privilege to isolate from the world. We have the ability to isolate from the world. And so we often take that, and it can take a lot of different forms. And so I think what this guy was trying to say was like, no, if we isolate ourselves, like we're really not actually ever dealing with the world, and we can't live out the kingdom of God if we are isolated. Mm-hmm. So even while we may feel like we're not isolated because we're in like some like a virtual, you know, reality or whatever, we actually are. It's like the oasis is not reality. There's no, it isn't. It isn't love your neighbor as yourself, your virtual neighbor as yourself. It's like, so I think maybe that's an antiquated way that I'm thinking, but I also look at it is that this new technology, I think we were talking about before the podcast, because I'm a big old fanboy of Emmanuel Lubezki. And
yes, Inuyuritu.
Inuyuritu. And we were talking about this weird Academy Award, and we alluded to it, I think, maybe last podcast.
Last podcast, yeah.
So I went and I looked it up. Inuyuritu and Lubezki made this virtual reality 7-minute experience that they think they had for the Cannes Film Festival. I think that's right. And where you are fully immersed in the film. Like you can look around, you can walk around, you do things. And I mean, it's like pretty cool.
Okay.
Anyway, there's been one feature length that was a really terrible Christian film about the life of Christ.
It was a virtual reality Christian film?
And it's feature length. Anyway, you can look that up. I can't remember the name of it. So this is called Flesh and Sand. That's a translation from the Spanish. And what I thought was interesting is they're using virtual reality in a different way. Cause it's not an oasis is like an escape from reality and the reality being like a desert, right?
Right.
What's funny to me is that this won the special for the first film in like 21 or 22 years to win a special Academy Award that for people who demonstrate something so amazing, such an advance that there's not a category for it. And so anyway, this won, the 7-minute film won that for the first time since Toy Story.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know, right? And so what this film, now here's the subject, this will blow your mind. So the subject of the film is it immerses people, and this is like at Cannes. So these are like some of the wealthiest people like in the world, and it immersed them in the shoes of someone trying to cross the border from Mexico to the United States through a desert versus an oasis, right?
In virtual reality.
In virtual reality, so that you look around and they put you in the place of being like basically in a prison, like being imprisoned. Like as you're having to get into a truck and doing all these other things in a 7-minute time period.
Yeah.
And so what virtual reality did is it gave you the perspective of the other rather than a place to like exercise your wildest fantasies. It said, no, virtual reality can show you like, all the reviews, cause I can't go see this. I'd like to see it, said it's not contrived or moralistic. It's just like is.
Right.
Because, and I'd expect that from those guys. Like they are like
how powerful is that?
It's so powerful.
From Inuyuritu and Lubezki. I mean, like I can't even imagine. That. I want to go see that.
I know, me too. But like, it might be in some museum in LA, but I don't remember. It is somewhere. Like you can go do that somewhere, but I don't know where.
But what look a powerful way to use that technology.
But yeah, so they're using VR. So nobody even knew. Like, so we're watching the Oscars, and that's like a category that they don't do.
They show it like for a second. Like,
but it's all we have is like once every like 20 years. Like there hasn't been one, and they don't even show the category.
Since Toy Story. Come
right.
On.
So now here's the other weird thing.
Okay.
A bunch of Spielberg movies and Lucas movies have won this category prior. So Raiders of the Lost Ark, Close Encounters, I think 2 or 3 of the Star Wars movies, like the first ones, won this because of innovations in film. Also, so, these are all fandom movies. Mm-hmm. Another one that won was, it's RoboCop, and I think, I'm forgetting the other one, RoboCop and Superman. But these are like all like similar directors who've basically been pushing those limits. I guess what I'm saying is Spielberg and some of these earlier movies were pushing these limits.
Yeah.
Now it's these other guys. It's Lebesky and it's Inarritu. And so like, they're the future Spielbergs. Yeah. But we keep going to Spielberg hoping to see something new. But now we need to go to like this Lubezki and Inarritu. Anyway, I'm like really passionate about it.
Yeah.
I think that that's where it's at.
Fantastic. So are you saying... Yeah. Where would you fit Spielberg then? So if they're ahead and they're the new Spielbergs, what's Spielberg doing?
So I think he's just... I think we hit this in the post, okay? So the post is a hard movie because he made it very quickly because he thought it was timely in response to Trump.
Right, right.
In our political climate. Ready Player One is not that way. It was in development for a long, long time and he took a lot of time with it. I don't think Ready Player One is capable of producing... I think the story is weak. It's a weak story. I think the technology is there. I think it's full of Easter eggs, but I don't think it gives us a narrative that's powerful enough to draw us deeply into it versus some of his other stuff. Like E.T. has a powerful narrative and all he has to do is shoot some action figures.
Right. Or even more modern, like if you think of Minority Report, there's a sci-fi fantasy movie that just gets you between the eyes.
And that's Spielberg, right?
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
It is. Mm-hmm. So I just don't get it. Like I'm even a fan of AI. So we have so many examples of him going into the realm of the fantastical where there was genuine emotion, there was something that actually grabbed you, and then you have this, which I thought was good. It's a good movie, but it doesn't come near to those films. So why is he regressing after all this time, or what's going on? I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But this critique has been made before of him.
Mm-hmm.
So like with Jurassic Park and Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how can you make these two films right next to each other? Like what? Right. How can you? It's about like, it's this goofy dinosaur movie. I mean, it's a great movie. We love it.
To be fair, those are both great movies. I mean,
they are both great movies, but they're so different.
They are. Yeah.
No, I just think like creatively, I think he's in his 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do things in your 70s, but I think his creative power is not where it used to be. And I think I said that in the post.
Hmm.
So you can. It doesn't matter how many people you surround yourself with. If you haven't been doing things that are innovative, you haven't been doing things that are innovative.
Yeah, I mean, you see it with bands. You know, I mean, there's that one album that you fell in love with, and they're still making music, but there's not that magic anymore. I don't know.
Are you being experimental or are you being excellent? So like, I think there's that's a climate, right? That's a soft. I mean, if we talk about software developers, they want a climate of innovation, which means failure. So you fail and you fail and you try and then you fail and you try and you fail.
Yeah.
But what I see with Spielberg films now is there isn't a climate of innovation. It's just a climate of perfection.
Yes.
So instead of like trying new things, it becomes we have to make this perfect every time.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is cool, and I think about Christianity, is like I hope that our churches and I hope that our artists and Christian artists would see that we would have a climate of innovation where we're encouraged to try new things and fail.
Yes.
Because we'd be seeking something better. It's like Inarritu and Lubezki and also like Spielberg, but not now Spielberg, but Spielberg from 25 years ago.
Right. Spielberg on the set of Jaws with a shark that intermittently works.
There you go. Right. And that's it right there.
Back against the wall. Right.
I've never seen anything like this. Nobody's ever done anything like this.
Uh-huh.
That's what we're talking about. Yeah. Or Lucas playing with models and blowing stuff up. Nobody's ever seen it. Or Industrial Light and Magic, RoboCop. Superman. I mean, all this stuff that nobody had ever done before.
Yeah.
And now somebody dared to try it. And like Star Wars was supposed to, I mean, it might've been a huge, huge failure, but somebody tried it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really critical.
Yeah. Oh, it's good. I mean, and that's, I think what we're saying is that this technology has the potential to ruin the world. There's no question. And it probably will bring a lot of dark, unforeseen consequences. But it also has the power, as with any technology, to do some really incredible things. And I love that idea of being able to place someone, literally being able to go into someone else's shoes.
Right.
See life through their vantage point. I hope that we will have innovative artists like Inarritu that will take virtual reality to that level and really bring about the common good.
So it's funny, like, yeah, it's like the contrast is so big. It's like one, where you see, I mean, it's not Spielberg that's doing it, but it's the writer.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that somebody would choose to like, well, if I were going to be a VR, I'd become the most powerful superhero. I'd be the most powerful avatar, have the most money and own the whole joint. Like that becomes what Spielberg's film is about versus Inarritu's film is like, well, what would you do? I'd put somebody who is the most powerful person at the Cannes Film Festival, who has everything, and to have it get sponsored. He got it sponsored by not Versace, but some big name Italian designer. Mm. And I would put them in the place of somebody crossing the border to look for a better life. Mm. And it's like the same exact technology we're talking about.
Yep.
But one person envisions this power and domination, and the other person envisions someone else's perspective. So it's kind of it's the stories we tell, I think.
Yep.
I mean, that's a big deal. Anyway, sorry, I got passionate.
I love it.
Yeah.
So, all right, final thoughts, Tim. Three things. I want your overall impression of the film, where you think it ranks as far as a Spielberg movie is concerned, and your letter grade. Three things. Go.
Fun. It's fun. Like, it's a fun movie, right? Like, my kid is going to love it. Okay. There's some bad words in it, so he'll love it a little bit later in life. But yeah, my kid's going to love it. It's fun. It's an adventure. He's a master of tension. So you always feel like something's happening. Pacing is not an issue with him. My letter grade would be a C+, because I think it's vacuous, morally vacuous. Mm. And I think the characters aren't there. And it's full of Easter eggs, so it's almost like a video game itself. So it's full of all these things, but I don't see a lot of meaning in it.
All right, fair enough. So I'll say that overall I had some trouble with the movie at first in the early stretches, but once I settled into the groove of it, my defenses melted away and I got lost in it. And overall, I like this movie a lot. I like that it reminded me of the movies that why I fell in love with film in the first place, why I fell in love with video games in the first place. And I think overall it's a really fun ride. I think repeat viewings are going to be great. I watched it with my 10-year-old and I can't wait to watch it with him again. And as a Spielberg movie, I would say it ranks somewhere in the middle, lower tier of his best works.
But yeah, I agree with you.
I mean, Close Encounters, E.T., Minority Report, I mean, it doesn't even...
doesn't touch any of that.
It's in the same league. But overall, I do think it's a good movie. I think it's worth seeing, especially in the theater. And my grade, and probably this is way too generous, and I'm going to shoot myself when I see it again, but I'm going with a B+. I know, it's all right. But it won me over in the end, and I kind of walked out of there like a 12-year-old.
What won you over, like, specifically? Because I'm, like, really curious, because this movie alienated me. But what won you over? Because there must be something. I may be missing something.
It was that feeling. It was just the purity of my childhood. That's all I could think about, was that Spielberg tapped in to that place in my heart that reminded me of why I do this podcast and why I watch movies and why I like playing Super Mario Odyssey with my son. And just that's what I think. Holiday really represents that in the movie, and I think he tapped into that feeling for me. And so I walked away just kind of flying high in my head. So that's all I can say. Yeah.
So sentimental. It's like a sentimental journey for you.
It was.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got you.
But I totally see the criticisms that you're making, which as I'm giving it a B+, I'm thinking I'm probably going to downgrade
it's
it
fun.
When I see it
no,
again.
No, it's fun, and it is full of that reference. So So if that's like what you're going for, then it's there. I mean, it's there.
All right. Well, that is Ready Player One, and we are ready for another huge blockbuster film.
Oh my gosh. How much copyright is involved in all these films?
I know. In just a couple weeks, man, we are going to watch The Avengers Infinity War. It's happened. Now, Tim, I know that you're apprehensive about this one, and I gave it some thought. And here's my thing. I know you haven't seen all the Marvel movies, and you don't have time and money, because who does, to go through all, 15 Marvel movies to get ready for this?
It's amazing how, 12 of the 15 were, on Netflix, and as soon as, 6 months before Infinity War, they're gone.
Of course they are. Yeah. They want you to spend $5 each to do it.
Oh, man, it's going to cost me $150 to do this podcast.
But here's the thing. I think that you're going to offer a nice perspective that's different from mine, because I've seen all the movies. I'm a huge fanboy of the films, and so I'm going to go into it with that mindset. You're going to be able to be more objective, because you're going to be able to treat it more as just seeing the movie as the movie. And there's going to be people that listen to our podcast that haven't seen all the Marvel movies and don't have time to either, and they're going to be more interested in your vantage point. So I think we should go ahead and do it. I know that you're apprehensive.
So can it function on its own?
Exactly.
I could be that voice.
Right.
I don't know who these people are. Ragnar what?
Exactly. And I'll be the counterpoint. So let's do it. It's going to be fun.
Okay. I could be the ignorant one.
Yep.
That's yep. good. Good. It's real. I don't play it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to be really ignorant.
Awesome. And so we'll be here in just a couple weeks to talk about that. And if you haven't already, we would love for you to go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating and review. It helps us so, so much. Thank you to everyone who's done that. We really appreciate it. And hey, if you got a comment or a rant or, hey, what the heck are you guys talking about? We'd love for you to send us your feedback at podcast@cinemafaith.com.
Tell us why we're wrong or right, or absolutely. Just talk about that we didn't mention the DeLorean or whatever.
Mention the DeLorean.
Oh, but we didn't talk about the what's that thing?
The Iron Giant?
No, we didn't talk about
it. We didn't talk about that.
Somebody's going to have to tell you what the heck that is. Or that, what's that thing? The Mecha Godzilla or whatever?
Uh-huh.
Come on. There's lots of stuff that we missed. You can tell us all the Easter eggs. Write them all down.
Yep. Blast us at podcast@cinemafaith.com. That is our email address. And that is our show for today. So, Tim, thank you as always. See you in a couple weeks. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.